Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. How do we know if our food supply is safe? That's a question today as much as it was a century ago, although one obscure chemist is believed to have paved the way for today's efforts to protect food consumers. Harvey Washington Wiley spent his life warning Americans about fakery in food, and he's the subject of a book out today by Deborah Blum, director of MIT's Knight Science Journalism Program. Thanks for coming in, Deborah.
Thank you for having me here.
So you call Harvey Washington Wiley the first great food safety chemist. Who was he, and why was he so interested in food safety?
Well, he was the chief chemist at the Department of Agriculture starting in the late 19th century when there was no FDA. There were no consumer protection federal laws of any kind, and he ran this tiny lab that was responsible, among many other things, for food safety, and that was just a particular passion of his. Huh. So he, in fact, almost redirected this little laboratory in the 1880s and said, let's really take a meticulous look at American food. And what they found was so horrifying to him that this became a lifetime crusade.
Okay, so of course we have to ask you about some of these horrifying things, but we also want to point out that this was a time when businesses were trying to figure out how to make food cheaper, and there were also industrial chemicals being introduced that could be used as preservatives. So tell us a little bit about the context of the time we're in, and then some of those things that were happening at the time that really probably just stoked the fire of Wiley's passion here for food safety.
Yeah, that's a great context. So if you go early in the 19th century, it's a much more rural society. People live on the farm, they're milking their own cows, they're growing their own vegetables. And as we get into the later 19th, we're shifting more into an industrial society. More and more people are moving to cities, they're working in factories, and frankly, they're not being paid very well. And so they don't have very much money. And so the food manufacturing industry and the industrial chemistry industry that are rising at the same time, one of the things they really obviously see as a wonderful way both to feed the poor and to extend profits is how can we take, the food supply and manufacture foods and extend them and alter them and put in fake ingredients and all of these things that will make what looks like wonderful farm fresh food available to people who really can't afford that because they're not making any money. So that's part of the impetus of this, mm-hmm. right? Is this pure profit motive at a time when you really can do anything you want because everything that you do to food is legal in the late 19th century. And so it's like an open canvas to cheat if Oof. You're of that mind.
Right. Sounds dangerous. So what happened? Tell us what some companies did.
So the ones that really interested me, I'm a coffee drinker. Coffee was often dyed sawdust or ground bones and dyed sawdust, and it would be dyed black, and then they'd mix in a little real coffee. They faked the coffee beans, and that was usually like dirt and wax in a mold that looked like coffee beans, and you'd mix them up. They were extenders, right? But someone I just was talking to said that they wondered if the, that joke, a muddy cup of coffee, comes from the fact that your coffee really used to be muddy.
Oh, boy.
The cinnamon was often brick dust. They put stone, ground stone, into bread as an extender. They faked alcohol. I mean, just would make industrial alcohol and dye it and pretend it was scotch. And my favorite is always milk, because milk did come, right, from farms. And then people would skim off the cream. They would re-whiten the milk with chalk or plaster. They would fake cream in extreme cases by pureeing calf brains and floating them on top of the milk. So you thought you were buying this beautiful farm fresh bottle of milk, but what you were buying was a completely legal fake. And then finally, really quickly, they would use they used preservatives. This is before refrigeration. Huh. So they used formaldehyde. They used 20 Mule Team Borax was a preservative. And they would just throw these untested compounds into food.
Huh. And I imagine people got sick.
But even when they used to have both the formaldehyde in milk, they'd have what they called embalmed milk scandals where children died. But it was legal. Right. The federal government had not made that an illegal practice. This is this wonderful time of business creative energy, and putting formaldehyde in milk was one of those creative impulses, in a sense, huh. Right?
So no public outcry, or what was the public saying about
this? Well, one of the
this?
Things also, the public slowly got angry, but one of the things also is there's no labeling. So people might get sick, but they didn't always know it was the milk. They didn't always know it was the cleaning product, borax, in their meat. They didn't always know that it was many of these, you know, peculiar fakes that were making them sick. And there was no public health system at the time either. So you get this sort of low-growing epidemic. So one of Wiley's jobs, and he took this mission on himself, was to sort of pick up a megaphone and say, yo, hey, food is really dangerous. Pay attention, because this is a system that is doing you harm, your children harm, your family's harm. We need to change this.
So then we get the Pure Food and Drug Act.
Right.
And so help?
Yes. And, you know, so that is actually the first great consumer protection law in the United States. It's really groundbreaking in that the government for the first time says, you know, promote the general welfare actually means things like make your food safe. And it's also a really bad law. It was a dogfight to get. It was known at the time as Dr. Wiley's law across the country. But it was altered by very close relationships between business and government. And so it changed some things for the huge better. We got formaldehyde out of the food supply instantly, okay. Right? We got other dangerous chemicals. We created a list of acceptably non-life-threatening food dyes, which we still use today. We still use the dyes approved by Wiley. We did all kinds of positive changes. We set in place the first apparatus. But it wasn't an adequate law. It was Wiley himself wrote a book the year before his death. This was in 1929, called The History of a Crime Against the Food Law, in which he just detailed all the ways that government and business had colluded to undo protection.
So he also, before we get into sort of how that plays out today and what's happened in terms of policy, the title of your book is The Poison Squad, right? And that refers to experiments that Wiley led for the Department of Agriculture to test preservatives.
That's right. And
humanly test preservatives.
Humanly test preservatives. You could never do these today. So about in 1902, when he's been, you know, battling for 20 years to get some kind of law, he finally says, okay, then, let's actually look at whether these things are safe. There's no safety testing. There's nothing available. I'm going to talk young government employees into dining dangerously. And he sets up this experiment, which was nicknamed the Poison Squad by the Washington Post, in which he gets young men to come in. They get three free meals a day, 7 days a week, but they have to take capsules of different preservatives. They have to have formaldehyde with every meal, or borax with every meal, or copper sulfate, which was a metal used to make vegetables greener. And then he just watches them in different doses compared to a group that doesn't get any, and tracks their symptoms. He had doctors, and they took all kinds of blood tests and other things. And he said, this really surprised me because these were so much more dangerous than I thought. And they got huge national attention. So they were one of the things in which he was able to effectively make a huge noise and say to the American public, you're in trouble. And people said, we're in trouble. You have to change this. That was one of the political forces that actually got us the first law.
Right. So, you know, laws on the books are great, and they can help consumers, and they can certainly help with some of these things. But people find ways to get around laws, as we know. And you mentioned, you know, for example, labeling. Yes,
right.
We can know how much sodium is in a particular product. But if there's something particularly dangerous that maybe we don't have to list, maybe it's not listed, and therefore a consumer could still be in danger from ingesting that particular food item. I mean, do we have enough protections now?
I want to start by saying we're a lot better off than we were, right, before we had none. But no, I don't think we do. And some of that is we rather stubbornly refuse to actually pay for the kind of inspections and safety testing that we need. So even the Food Safety Modernization Act that was passed and signed under Barack Obama to update us into the 21st century has not been really funded. So we're not putting those standards in place. So you can get two things happen. One, there are ingredients in food that don't turn up on labels, and that's because there's gaps in the laws that don't require them, or there are ingredients that we find on the labels with the assumption that they're safety tested when they're actually not. So the FDA has this kind of, they call it generally recognized as safe. And so if a compound's been around for a while and people aren't dropping dead in the streets, you can just use that without safety testing it. And so you might see it on a label, titanium dioxide in food, say, but that's just there. It's generally recognized and safe, but no one has safety tested it in food. So in that sense, I think we have a long way to go in being really transparent about what's in food, what puts it at risk.
And just very briefly, too, we also, what about claims about food now, right? We've got probiotics, we've got CBD, we've got all of these other in terms of our food supply, and does the food do what it's supposed to do? I mean, anybody in charge of making sure that's is what it's supposed to be.
Not really effectively. And that's an important point in this, and I'm going to say it quickly. It is unfair to ask the consumer to always function in a buyer beware way. None of us have the bandwidth to study all of these things. I'm a toxicology writer, and I don't know them all, right? And I would talk to toxicologists who don't. So it is the role, I can't say that, of the American government. The American government needs to step up and investigate these things and say, we put you, the average consumer who's confused in the grocery store, we're putting you first here. And we're going to do the investigation and we're going to tell you what this thing in your food means or whether this claim about your food is real. And I think we have the right to expect that. And I think we should. I think we should hold it to a higher standard.
Just very briefly, we have less than a minute. If Wiley were around today, what would be his pet peeve?
Almost exactly what I just said. We're not putting the consumer first in the way that he would like us to do.
Okay. Deborah Blum, current director of MIT's Knight Science Journalism Program. Her new book is titled The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Crusade for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century. She'll be at the Museum of Science tomorrow night for the book's launch. There's more information on our website, radioboston.org. Deborah Blum, thanks very much for being with us. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.